In Portsmouth Barracks. I was Portsmouth. The other half of the apprentices were sent to Plymouth. Every other class went to Portsmouth. Every other class went to Plymouth. As a coppersmith, I had to go into the coppersmith shop, and here we had to march from the barracks to the dockyard, go into the coppersmith shop. And the first thing I remember about that is the huge, great pipes, 18 inches diameter, which were being blasted with hot flames, and being pulled round into bends by men with winches, and these pipes were filled with sand to stop them kinking, and they would make these pipes red hot and pull them round with machinery, and then go bang 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 while they knocked out the dents, and it was really exciting to watch it happen.
Ronald Jesse Reel 2. Tell me more about that, your time as an apprentice coppersmith.
Yes, the odd thing about the dockyard routines was that the men came quite early. I should think about 7 o'clock in the morning to start their day. But at 9 o'clock, they had a stop for breakfast. So we naval apprentices had a completely different routine, and we would have breakfast, I suppose, at 7:30 or 8, and march round to the dockyard at 8:30. And at 9 o'clock, we had to be quite quiet and not make any noise or do anything, because all the dockyardmen were having their breakfast, and I mean breakfast. It was sausage and bacon on the coppersmith's fires. The whole shop was filled with individual blasted fires with a blast, that is. We were tucked away in one corner to do our training, and there were selected dockyard coppersmiths who were appointed to be our instructors, but we had to be quiet. So we secreted lumps of bread from breakfast, and we made tins out of tin sheet and soldered them together to make tea on the fire, and we had our breakfast, which was and we did it all secretly and quietly, went out of sight of everyone, until one day our instructor caught us doing it, and he said, "Do you realise you could give yourselves lead poisoning by drinking out of a tin that was made with soldered joints?" So we hurriedly stopped that. The apprentices' work was mainly how to manipulate tubes, and we started off with small tubes and then bigger tubes, and eventually we had to actually make the tubes out of sheet metal and join them in cunning ways, and it was pleasant until you came to do what's called fire brazing with spelter and quite a big joint, and you had to build a big fire. You had to hang your pipe over the fire by chains, and you had to twist it this way and that over the flames until it was red hot, and then you had to apply the spelter to run the joint together, and it was like an inferno with a fierce flames blowing, and this red hot pipe, and you had to manipulate it and tap it and bang it and throw borax onto it, and you were absolutely shattered and red hot, and in fact one's face skin was quite blistered if you didn't watch out. So that was the horrendous part of coppersmithing. The nice part was beating sheet metal into different shapes, and I still enjoyed that experience of beating metal into a chosen shape to this day.
How long did that part of your training last?
Well, the whole of my apprenticeship was. Can I take you back from to where we were? We were only in Portsmouth Dockyard for about a year. So out of the 4 years, I spent my first 18 months either in Chatham or in Portsmouth Dockyards. But meanwhile, a whole new training establishment had been built down at Tor Point on the other side of the river from Plymouth. And we were all moved down there together. And we were all in one factory then, the machining, the coppersmithing, the boiler making, the engine smithing and foundry work were all in one marvellous factory, and it was a real joy to work there, to be a trainee there.
Did you spend the rest of your time?
And I spent the rest of my time there. Yes. Now that was a whole different life. We had wooden huts to live in. I think there were brick at the bottom and wood at the top. And the place had been built in really short order. Wooden huts to live in. We had a proper mess hall with civilized kitchens. There was a parade ground. There was the factory at the back. The classrooms where we did technical instruction of an evening. We were allowed to go on cross country runs and cycling and sailing in Plymouth Harbour, and we could also go a short distance over to a little place on the beach that I've forgotten the name of, and you could actually walk there and swim off the beach if on a Saturday afternoon. You could go ashore to Plymouth at the weekends and have a feed up, and I actually went to a dancing class at one time, I remember. And they go to the cinema. It was a very pleasant life. It wasn't so pleasant when the Germans came and flattened Plymouth on an air raid. We sent parties over to help out as best we could, but that wasn't at all pleasant. And we had a couple of bombs in our factory.
Tell me about the impact of the war on your life and how you.
It was exciting. I remember the moment that war was declared. I was at home, and I heard Chamberlain's speech, and my mother started crying, and we had an evacuee lady billeted upon us, and mother said, "Well, this isn't going to work, two of us in the same kitchen. I'm sorry, we can't. You'll have to think of something different." But I was just plainly excited. All the rules and regulations seemed to disappear, and you, if it needed doing, you did it, no matter what. We had at Tor Point, we had sentry duties to perform. We had to patrol the perimeter. We had to stand at the gate with our rifles. And we were taught to say, "Halt, who goes there?" I mean, what absolute nonsense. If there had been any invasion, they would have swept us to one side without a second's thought. But I mean, saying, "Halt, who goes there?" What nonsense. During 1941, when the invasion scare was on, we were put to making knobkeries. Do you know a knobkery? It's an African club, and we made them by taking lengths of brass tubing, which we had plenty of, about two or three feet long, say 2 foot six, and moulding on the end a big lump of lead in a lead mould, and we made hundreds of these and issued them out all around the naval base, so that at least everybody had something to whack with. And another thing we did was to design a gun mounting. The Lewis gun, which there seemed to be some of, but they weren't mounted. They were a gun with a flat pan, and they were designed for use in trench warfare. But because of the air raids that were coming over, we were asked, could we design a mounting that these things could be put on the mounting and swung round to shoot at airplanes. They're quite heavy. You couldn't have possibly have held it up in the air by your hands. And I remember helping to design one of these things, and we made half a dozen of them, I suppose. I was horrified at the thought of our forces being driven out of Europe, of course, but I wasn't in the least bothered about the Germans coming over. I just plainly knew that with our fleet, we would intercept them and send them all to the bottom. That was my boyish thought. I'd been brought up to the understanding that the British Navy was absolutely undefeatable and all powerful, and I just was sure that nobody would ever make it across the Channel. In latter years, of course, I come to realise that this was anything but the case. However, full of confidence.
You talked about the bombing of Plymouth. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Not really. We were in our air raid shelters, of course, most nights at that time, and we were doing our homework in the air raid shelters, I remember, and the smell is something that I remember, the smell of an air raid shelter, where it's dank and unpleasant and never opened up to fresh air. It always smells, it's terrible. But in our air raid shelter, and we could see the glow of fires across the horizon in the direction of Plymouth, and the planes flying over, and the shell bursts of anti-aircraft fire. We were not allowed to wander very far from our air raid shelters, obviously. And we never had tin hats, so you had to keep undercover because of the falling shrapnel. The din was fairly tremendous. We had a set of anti-aircraft guns just up the hill from the establishment, and they would be barking away all night, bang, 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 making a terrible din. Apart from that, I never had any direct experience of the air raids.
Were your siblings in the forces?
Yes. My elder brother, I had two, starting from the top. Sister Flora was a school teacher, and she was teaching in an infant school all through the war. My second sister was in the NAFI in Chichester. My eldest brother was in the Navy, having been through Holbrook as a seaman, and he was a petty officer, and he was sunk and died in action. My second brother had weak ankles and a weak tummy, and he was put to munitions work in Coventry, and he became a major in the Home Guard on radio work, on communications. My third brother was also in the Navy, and he went through the war and survived. My younger sister was too young, she was 5 years older than me. And she was going through college to be a teacher as well. So that's my siblings. So
what ship was your brother on when he was
A variety of... I'm sorry?
When he sunk.
Yes. It was a Q ship. It was a secret ship that looked like a tramp. And it was going out to Singapore to beat hell out of the Japanese, and it was in a convoy, And unfortunately, it got separated from the convoy and sunk by a torpedo. And he went down. And the name of the ship escapes me for the moment, but I'll research it if you would like me to.
How long were you at Torpoint?
Until 19... November 42, and I went straight into the Navy proper January 43, and was assigned to the Belfast.
That was your first ship?
Well, the first ship. And all us apprentices were put into Portsmouth Barracks, and it's occurred to me since that they must have just run down the list putting these apprentices to ships proper for training. Because although we'd finished our apprenticeship, we didn't know one end of a ship from the other for training. And Belfast had said, we'll take five, and they took a block of five. And that we were Govan, Henson, Jesse, English, you know, in alphabetical order. And they just sorted us out from the list in alphabetical order. And we... were kitted out with kit bag, hammock, sea clothes, overalls, and all that sort of thing for going to sea, and a toolbox. And we got on our train in Portsmouth Barracks one morning, and we went all up through the country, going through London, being shunted into sidings to let proper trains go by, being shunted into sidings to let air raids pass by, stopping at stations for cups of tea, and we arrived in Thurso at the top of Scotland two mornings later. So that was 48 hours. And we were sick to death of that train, and we went into a forces station on the seafront in Thurso, and we're given breakfast, a proper sit-down breakfast with knife and fork and cups and tea and stuff, which we hadn't had for 2 days, hadn't had proper meals for 2 days. And then we got into a fishing trawler. Hundreds of us got into a fishing trawler. And I was talking about a train load of people. The whole draft for the home fleet. And we were taken out in this fishing trawler to Scapa Flow. You know Scapa Flow? And we went all round the ships of Scapa Flow, and the Belfast was the last one. So not only were we seasick going across the Pentland Firth, but we were sick to death of that trawler by the end of the day. And it was about 6 o'clock in the evening before we eventually climbed up the gangway onto our first ship.
What was your impression of the Belfast the first time you saw her?
Huge. Absolutely tremendous. And I was very... taken aback by the fact that there was such a gap between the bridge and the funnel. Can you see? The gap between the bridge and the funnel. Because near all the ships that I had either seen or knew about had the first funnel up behind the bridge. So that was my first impression. And we put our kit on the quarter deck and were taken along to our messes to be given an evening meal, and we walked into the engine room artificer's mess, and I was so amazed. There were tables with white cloths, and fish cakes, and tomato sauce. And that was the second meal of my life that I can remember. Both fish cakes and tomato sauce. But it was white bread. The cutlery was immaculate. The plates were immaculate, and I had been expected to be using enamelled dishes and saucers, which I had experienced back in Greenwich many years before. But it was quite the opposite, and it was the most delightful experience. Very crowded. The ship was up to full war complement with people like us on as supernumeraries for training, so very crowded. We were taken to find a place to sleep that night, and the only place that they could find for us five was in the workshop, and there were hammock bars above the workshop, and I was having to climb up over a lathe and make the best I could over this lathe and put my kit bag and my suitcase and my gas mask and my everything else into some odd corner. And we didn't have a proper place to be. You had to go to the mess and in two shifts have your meals and make your way the best you could.
First night
I slept like a log. I had never slung a hammock before.
Pause there because of the hailstorm, which begins to drown you out a bit. We were talking about your first impressions of the Belfast and your first night on board. Can you remember anything else about that first day and night?
Yes, the night was okay. I can remember sleeping. The next morning was horrendous. There was the most terrific lot of gabble over the ship's tannoy system. Wakey, wakey, wake up and show us the lights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody had to turn out. And then I had to lash my hammock up, trying to negotiate my way around this lathe machine, which was directly underneath, and to tie it up properly. Now, tying up a hammock is an art form, and it is ever so easy to get it completely wrong, and that when you've finished, everything falls out again. And my next days and weeks were in a state of fear and trembling, because it was ever so easy to do the wrong thing on the ship. There were pitfalls and rules and regulations and conventions to be broken nearly everywhere and doing everything. You were confined to your part of the ship. That is to say, if you were an engineer, you were confined to the engines and boiler rooms, the main walkways, and your mess. You were not allowed into any of the storerooms, into the galleys, into the officers' quarters, unless you had a job to do, and still less were you allowed out on deck if you were not properly dressed, if you're in your old dirty boots and overalls. You were either working or you were in your mess. And the trouble was, in the evening times, the mess was full because there were more people than could be safely easily accommodated in the mess. And there weren't very many places to go where you could be comfortable. Lots of people found a little hole in the corner somewhere behind a piece of machinery or on top, sitting, putting a blanket on top of an electric motor, something like that, where you could sit comfortably, and that was their little cubbyhole. And did you dare do anything to spoil their cubbyhole? Woe betide you. I had a coppersmith's shop I could retire to, but it wasn't very pleasant. It was in the base of the after funnel, along with the. There were a couple of us coppersmiths, and there was a blacksmith. And the blacksmith had been on the ship a long time before me, and he knew it all. He was an much older man, and I was a boy of 19. And he ruled the roost in this shop with two forges and two benches and two anvils, one for him and one for us, coppersmiths. But we... the hardest part of my work was to find the things I had to go and work on. We were given jobs at 8 o'clock in the morning. We formed an orderly queue and went past the desk where Lieutenant Simpson, the senior engineer, handed out the work for the day, and he had a job book, and you were given a job from the job book, and you had to go and find this job, and it's usually repairing leaks. nearly always repairing leaks, because leaks were horrendous and they wasted water, which apart from never getting any better, they wasted water, and a leak had to be jumped on quite quickly. But finding the piece of machinery that he was talking about was the first problem, and then finding the piece, the actual leak on this piece of machinery. Bear in mind, although I had been taught all about the innards of the machinery, when it was covered in lagging, it didn't look anything like what it was drawn in the book. And so I had to ask somebody, where's the starboard forward feed pump and the something-something drain valve? And he would have to point it out to me, and then I would have to take the safety precautions, ask somebody about taking the safety precautions, and how do I mend this leak, and so on. This is one weakness of the apprentice training system. There was no practical training for maintenance work of installed machinery. You were taught how they work and how to repair them when they're taken to bits, but no just common or garden maintenance work of installed machinery. And it took me quite a long time to find out where everything was and what it was called. In the course of the next 6 months, I made a point of getting a sketchbook and drawing the run of every pipe in the ship. And I mean literally the route taken by every pipe in the ship, so that I could find it under torch-like conditions, and know where all the valves were by heart, because I realised, and we were all encouraged to know this, because the day would come when we would need to know it in the dark and under battle conditions. My working day would either be in the coppersmith shop repairing pipes. That's why coppersmiths were carried in the Navy, was because of the leakage of copper pipes. But copper pipes don't corrode in seawater, but they do suffer from electrolysis and the eating away of the copper due to electrical circuits, especially from the degaussing gear.
What sort of equipment was supplied by, or was used copper pipes? What equipment used copper pipes?
Copper pipes were used in low pressure steam supplies and in seawater circuits. And some of the pipes were huge, and I'm talking 2 or 3 feet diameter. And other pipes were conventional or even quite small, but they all had a job to perform, and had to be kept in good order. There were steel pipes, of course, but usually steel pipes were beyond the our ability to manufacture. I could make quite a longish copper pipe with lots of bends in it, if need be, or repair a pipe. But steel pipes were really for dockyard work. The little shop we had was excruciatingly small, and it had a bench which was about 18 inches from front to back, and the bench had a lip so that things wouldn't fall off it, so you never had a flat surface to work on. We had oxyacetylene bottles stowed underneath the catapult, and to carry them up to the workshop meant going up a fairly steep ladder and along the gun deck. And I can remember the ease. I'm amazed now the ease with which I put one on my shoulder, shinned up this ladder and along the gun deck, and take the empty one back. I couldn't even begin to lift a heavy thing like an oxyacetylene bottle now.
Who else was in the workshop with you?
The blacksmith was in the smith shop, But sometimes I would get a job which entailed the preparation of new joints, where for some reason the joints had failed. And the art of the technique in those days was to scrape a flange absolutely flat with scrapers and testing the flatness by means of a thing called a surface plate. And then when both flanges were absolutely flat, you put them together with red lead paste, and then you had to go down into the machinery space and bolt them back together again. And this was okay for this, such a joint made properly would be okay for about a year and a half or 2 years, but it was joints were very prone to leaking from that method of sealing. And it wasn't until the Pacific War, when we discovered the Americans had much more sophisticated methods of jointing, that we got on top of the water leakage problems which all our ships were prone to.